सुखदं केवलं ज्ञानमूर्तिं द्वन्द्वातीतं गगनसदृशं धत्वमस्यादिलक्ष्यम् एकं नित्यं विमलमचलं सर्वधीसाक्षिभूतम् भावातीतं त्रिगुणरहितं सद्गुरुं तं नमामि. Let us offer our salutations to that true teacher who is the very embodiment of knowledge and who, like the sky, the one unique witness of all that lies beneath, he is utterly devoid of qualities and dualities, and yet he is the bestower of great bliss. To him our salutations again and again. Please turn to page 177. We have in the next two verses, 54 and 55, two of the most famous of the verses of this text. These are quoted right and left all over this place, and they are justly famous. They're definitions of Brahman. And I'm not going to do the Sanskrit tonight because it'll take more time. We're going to have to hurry. We've got to finish this book in two nights, tonight and the last Thursday of the month. So we'll go along rather quickly and try to finish it. Realize that to be Brahman, the attainment of which leaves nothing more to be attained, the blessedness of which leaves no other bliss to be desired, and the knowledge of which leaves nothing more to be known. All right, who can find Satchidananda in there? Satchidananda is hidden in there.
Blessedness.
Hmm?
The bliss.
Ananda will be the bliss. Chit will be the knowledge. Mm. And you can say Sat is the thing to be attained. Being, state of being, to be attained. Nothing more to be attained. You've got Sat. When you get there, you've got Ananda, the correct Ananda. And you've got Chit, the knowledge of everything. That, on that Monday, This brings up this subject. On that Monday when the group of candidates for the ministry came from the seminary, I told you, I think, that one of the ladies, having heard my shortened version of my journey, when I had described how I had been brought up by Protestant missionaries to China, and then had become a Quaker for several years, and from Quakerism I came to Vedanta. When question time came, she asked a question that nobody has ever asked me before. She said, "Well, how do I know that when I... Did I tell you this before? How do I know that when I come 10 years from now, you won't be a Baha'i?" In other words, she saw me as a hopper
50 years in Vedanta?
I said yes. I hope I'll be here in 10 years when you're here. I'll be lucky to be here in 10 years when you come back. But joking aside, she really wanted to know if I was such a hopper from one group to another. How could she be sure that I wouldn't find another group to go to? And why should she have any faith in my words? You know, that was the idea behind it. And this verse gives me an excellent opportunity to explain that. I told her that I had never found any other path or way or group which completely answered the questions that I had, which gave me the satisfaction that I had been seeking all my life. In other words, I made this kind of a testimony that having come in touch with Brahma at least a little bit, I have found that beyond which nothing needs to be attained, and that the blessedness of which leaves nothing else to be desired, and the knowledge of which leaves nothing else to be known. I didn't think of this verse at that time, but the point is, I am conveyed to her, there's an overwhelming feeling of satisfaction that was not there in the other places where I worked, lived, the other paths that I traveled. I traveled those paths, always unsatisfied, always searching. And when I came to my guru and when I came to Vedanta, I found the kind of satisfaction that I need to have. And I won't be likely to be a Baha'i or anything else 10 years from now. Notice, let's go to the notes. Attainment. This is because Brahman is the all-inclusive reality. I mentioned that to the lady. I said, since this understanding, this embracing of faith is so inclusive and acknowledges all the other paths and all the other faiths in a way that nobody else has, that I've known of, and does. That's another reason. So inclusive, all inclusive. Now, blessedness. Compare. This is another verse. This is from Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. This is his highest goal. And who is this he? Anybody? Who is this? What are they talking about? Who is he? This is his highest goal. Huh? No, Atman has no goal. Huh? Jiva. The sadhaka. The aspirant. Any aspirant. Uh-huh. This is his or her, the aspirant's highest goal. This is his highest success. This is his highest world. This is his highest bliss. All other creatures live on a small fraction of that bliss. Now, the Upanishad is saying what? It's saying that the important person is the human aspirant. There are lots of other creatures. They are not excluded from Brahma. They live on a particle of that divine bliss at Ananda. Taittiriya Upanishad says, who could live a moment, who could breathe a moment if that blissful one were not inspiring everything? It's because of that blissful Brahman or Atman within that people are able to experience bliss at all. And so this sage says, all other creatures live on a small fraction of that bliss. The human being is capable of realizing it in its fullness. That's one of the great, great features of being a human being, that we can attain to the summum bonum, the summation of human life, the bliss which is the summation of human life. And other creatures can only have experience it in particles. Swami Yatishwarananda, my teacher, used to say, whenever you experience a sense pleasure, any kind of sense pleasure, ice cream cone, whatever, any time that you get pleasure from something through the senses, a tiny bit of that ananda has come through. But it's so covered with the upadhis, it's so smeared over with the grime and mud of the senses and their inadequacy, that it is disguised, it's covered. But every time that we have an experience of pleasure, even from worldly things, we have to know that it is a part, it's an expression of that divine pleasure, that divine, not pleasure, bliss, that divine bliss, which is hidden in that experience. So that's what's being explained here, particles. Now, the question arises in that, on that note. Then you see, he who knows that highest Brahman becomes Brahman. The question then arises, well, but suppose that sadhaka, that aspirant, has attained this experience of highest Brahmanhood, and he is one of those people who doesn't die in 2 weeks, 3 weeks. He's a person who has prarabdha karma, if you were to follow that theory, or he's a person who has an agenda, a mission in the world. So he remains in the body and lives like one of us, and yet he's still a knower of Brahman. He's a jivan mukta, all right? Mm-hmm. So, what is he doing? Is he not subject to the vicissitudes of human life still? Are there not journeys to make, disappointments to have? Are there not accidents that happen? Are there not vicissitudes of all kinds coming into his life? Yes, we have to say many things may yet happen, may occur. Many things may occur, but to him, to that person, they are not in time. They are not in space. See, for us, Pranab loses Jayanti. It's going to take Pranab some months to get over that grief. That grief belongs to time. It belongs to space. The object is no longer present, and the time is only fit for remembering, not fit for experiencing. But because a knower of Brahman is not clinging to space and time and doesn't put these experiences into space and time, but sees them rather as a film passing over the prospect of eternity. The prospect before his eyes and his mind is eternity itself. Unlimitedness, no space, no time, the absolute. And this, whatever these vicissitudes are that come in the life after that, they're like a passing show. They are not significant for him. So, to get that idea, we have to, this verse is to inculcate that idea in our minds. Let's go on to 55. Another one like the same, starts the same way. Realize that to be Brahman, which, when seen, leaves nothing more to be seen, having become which, one is not born again into the world of becoming, and which, when known, leaves nothing else to be known. So, well, what about all the new discoveries? What about stem cell research? What about the latest computers? What about all of the many, many things that haven't been... They found to examine the brain of Archaeopteryx. Did you know that? Today they told on the radio they examined the brain of that odd creature, the Archaeopteryx, which is supposed to be the missing link between birds and reptiles. And they examined the brain by MRI or whatever it is that they use. They found out interesting things about the brain of that animal. What about all these things? There are all kinds of new things that are being discovered every day. So, what do you mean to say? He has no interest in those things? He won't listen to the radio? He won't see a movie? He won't... He has nothing else to know? Why? Somebody explain.
Not the same knowledge.
Hmm?
Not that kind of knowledge.
Yeah. I've put it down this way. Interest in new forms and names and ideas may be there in that mind of the Jivanmukta, but it will not be new, in quotes. To him it will not be new. To him it will seem like the uncovering of something that was always there. In other words, knowledge for him is always discovering the real, the ever-existing, a new twist on what is ever-existing. He sees everything as Brahman. This, oh, Brahman is now taking this form. Brahman is now taking that form. But to us, these things seem so new. Oh, this new program, a new doctrine, a new policy, a new proposal in Congress. New. Everything. We live from moment to moment, expecting something different. But to him, nothing is different. Everything is the same. Only interesting in the twist that it takes. It's almost impossible to describe this because you have to use words, and what that person experiences cannot be put into words. Words don't cover it. So that word "new" is very misleading. It traps us into thinking that forms, giving too much attention to the form. If when our minds run to the procession of names and forms, one after the other, and does not reflect the permanent, the real, then we have lost our balance. We've lost our balance and we are captivated by the newness of things, which in itself is not reality. The important thing, see that he says here, having become which, one is not born again into the world of becoming, and which, when known, is nothing else. Not born again into the world of becoming. Well, nothing can avert death and birth. So, second chapter of the Gita, for that which is born, death is certain. For that which is dead, birth is certain. Both are taken together by Sri Krishna, he says. Those things come into being from manifestation, from unmanifest, they come to manifest. From manifest, they go back to unmanifest. And this circle and cycle goes on and on and on. So, knowing this, one tries to get out of that cycle or circle of birth and death. And it can be done. It says that because becoming Brahman, one is not born again. Why should he be? Brahman never moves. So how can he be born? How can he die? How can it or he die? And what is important for the mind of the Jivan Mukta is meaning. If there's anything that he looks for in newness or new phenomena or in scientific research or in further exploration of the planet or the universe, outer space and so on, NASA's pictures and so on, what he's looking for is not marvel or newness or titillation of the mind. He wants meaning. He's always looking for meaning. And since the meaning of everything is Brahman, he always finds it. He always finds the meaning because the meaning of everything is Brahman. We go to what is apparently not Brahman in order to find out its meaning, and its meaning is always Brahman. I remember when Swami Bhashyananda one day, a very emotional woman came for interview, and very often Swami Bhashyananda's interviews were not conducted in private. He sat on the porch of the upper level of the center in Chicago, and he had no particular qualms about talking to people very intimately when other people were sitting around. We all knew it, so of course we were very careful. But this woman came in, and she was, I don't remember what it was about, but she was being quite emotional. Maybe she had had a dream or something. And he looked at her very sternly and severely, and he said, "I have nothing but pity for people who think that excitement is spirituality." Now put that in your pipe and smoke. "I have nothing but pity for those who think that excitement is spirituality, or that spirituality is excitement." I've forgotten which it was, but it works both ways. See, that's the nature of the restless mind. The mind in ignorance wants excitement, wants constant newness, constant stimulation. Everything becomes old hat and we want something new. I've played this song so many times, I'm subject to that. I've heard Beethoven symphonies for 50, 60 years. I don't get much out of a Beethoven symphony anymore because I've heard them all, and I've heard them so many times. It's different for Indian music. Indian music, you can make it different every time. But, you know, Beethoven wrote a score, and you have to play what the notes are on the score. So it comes out the same almost every time. Different conductors, different soloists, but same music. And the mind gets tired, and you say, "I want something new, I want something different." The whole point of this verse is that there is nothing different, really. And once you realize that, and once you become of that consciousness, then you don't seek excitement. You don't seek novelty. That's the word, novelty. Newness is one thing. Novelty is something else. Novelty is not spirituality. Spirituality doesn't require novelty. All right, let's go to the notes. Compare. Have you ever asked for that instruction? This comes from Chandogya, where the boy has been sent off to school. He and his brother have been sent off to school. And they come back. I think this is that story. And the brother, what have you learned of Brahma? The brother keeps silent. Silent. Father smiles with approval. Good. You know that nothing can be said. The other son starts talking. And then the father says, have you ever asked for that instruction by which we hear what is unheard, by which we perceive what is unperceived, by which we know what is unknown? And the son replies, showing his ignorance, sir, how can there be such a knowledge? How can there be knowledge of something which has never been known, which is unknown? And the father goes on in long length, giving him the knowledge of Brahman. So, that's the story on that one. On the next note, having become which, compare, it is my supreme abode, and they who reach it never return. This is 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. This is Sri Krishna saying that born, that place, that level.
Paramdhamma.
Yes, Paramdhamma, that's right. The Dhamma, abode. I can't quote the verse for you, but I should be able to, but I can't right now. And anyway, Sannivartante, Paramdhamma. Thank you, that's right. Tadharma, that's right, Tadharma. All right, so that Dhamma, that place, that realization, that state, is a state which my devotees, having reached, they never have to come back. This is a very definite stage of spiritual life. It happens especially to, in monastic life, it happens to those who stick on in monastic life with faithfulness, and very often they themselves are not aware of that condition. I remember that one of our monks came to Swami Ashokananda with a dream that he had had. And in the dream, some holy figure appeared to him. I think this is how it was. Somebody appeared to him and told him, ha, I see that you are rid of the incarnation. And he got worried. He believed that Sri Ramakrishna was the divine incarnation. And what would it mean that he got rid of the incarnation? So he went to Swami Ashokananda and asked him, told him the dream. And he said, this doesn't mean that I'm no longer have Sri Ramakrishna. Swami said, no. It means that you have become free of rebirth. It means you are free of rebirth. So the dream was no dream. It was a spiritual experience, actual experience. Very vivid dream, he told about it. And he said, and the Swami said to him, very, very softly, he said, don't worry about it. It means you are free of rebirth. So it's a definite stage that comes. There's more to go, farther to go, but that is at least what this verse is talking about. All right, now, what about people? Yes, I have to ask this question. Does it mean samadhi? Tricky now. I'm being tricky. This state of freedom from rebirth. Does that mean he had samadhi? You have samadhi?
Which samadhi?
Ah, that is a question. Yes, of course. It's savikalpa. If it's samadhi, it's savikalpa samadhi. See, What is said like this? It doesn't matter whether it is savikalpa or nirvikalpa, because those who get savikalpa samadhi are said to go to Brahmaloka. There is the presumption that at death, if you haven't had nirvikalpa, you have had savikalpa samadhi, you go to a place called Brahmaloka. This is all in the scriptures. I have never been there. I can't tell you. In the scriptures there. You go to a place called Brahmaloka, and then at the end of the cycle, end of the cosmic cycle, you merge into Brahman, and that have your nirvikalpa. Those who don't want nirvikalpa samadhi, those who haven't been able to get nirvikalpa samadhi, their position is Brahmaloka with savikalpa. They have presence of God. They have the feeling of unity with God. They have the same form of God. There are different qualifications. Sarupa, and
so on. It's not Swarga, right? Brahmaloka is not Swarga. It's not heaven.
No, not one of the heavens. It's the highest. It's next to Brahman. But it's a condition in which the soul of Savikalpa Samadhi remains until the expiration of the yuga. Well, that's all in the scriptures.
Swami, do you think there's a possibility you may have been there and you came back?
Me?
Yeah.
Well, they better tell me about it then.
They call it a yoga brashta action.
That is where if you go, you meet Ganesha and all? Are they there?
No, those are other lower heavens.
That is Kailash, see Kailash.
Those are lower heavens. There are not really any forms in Brahmaloka.
This is Vedant Brahmaloka.
But then I can't.
It is not our Vishnu Ganesh.
I can't verify it. Maybe Ganesh will turn up there if you want him to. I don't know.
It is in your mind.
Sounds like purgatory to me.
But my aunt, who lived up to 92,
yes,
and she was a very traditionally religious lady, and very smart, well-read, everything.
I know.
And when we had discussion of this kind, she would say, "I'm wondering why nobody who goes there comes back to tell us what it is like there." And right now, when I remember her, why don't you come and tell me?
Yeah, right. Well, that's it. You ask her, why doesn't she come? All right. We've had all, the next note, we've had all that about clay arising from speech. We don't have to read that one. Let's go on to 56. Realize that to be Brahman, which is existence, knowledge, bliss, absolute, which is non-dual and infinite, eternal, and one, and which fills all the quarters. All that is above and below, and all that exists between. These are, of course, repetitious verses. We've had all this before. Verse explaining the all-pervadingness of Brahman. Non-dual, and all that, infinite, eternal, and one. But it, if you still have a feeling of space, if you still think you live in Tucker, or in Decatur, or Atlanta, if you still think you have a street address, you have to have a street address so you can follow the watering restrictions.
Zones.
And zones. If you think you have all those things, then remember that he is to before, and he's behind. It is to the right, to the left. It has gone forth below and above. It has extended everywhere. Brahman alone is all this. It is the supreme. And I remind you of that day when Swami Vivekananda came down from his room and sat No, he stood. He came down from his room and stood in front of the gathered brahmacharis who were waiting for a class. He was to teach the class. And he came down the steps from his room, and he was in such an exalted state. And he said, he looked out upon these young men, and he said, "This is Brahma. Look, this." And they all had an experience. They all had a moment of awakening. Maybe it passed away, passed on, and a glimpse was gone, but for the moment, they saw what he was saying, that this is Brahma. And then the class began, because you can't sustain that with just one or two words. That invisible Brahman is full. No, yes, that invisible Brahman is full. This is Om Purnamadaha Purnamidam. This invisible Brahman is full. This visible Brahman is full. Purnamidam Purnat. Purnat Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate. This full visible Brahman proceeds from that full invisible Brahman. On grasping the fullness of this full visible Brahman, there is left that full invisible Brahman. It's a long-winded way of explaining the verse. It simply means that Brahman cannot possibly be affected in the least by what is supposed to have come out of it, and what is supposed to have gone into it, and what it is supposed to have done in the meantime. All of this is illusory. This visible manifestation, even though it is infinite because there is no end to the exploration of it, even though it is infinite and has come out of that Brahman, Brahman itself was never affected, just as the desert is not affected by the least drop of water of the mirage. Let's go to 57 and then realize that the Brahman, which is non-dual, indivisible, one, and blissful, and which is indicated by Vedanta as the irreducible substratum after the negation of all tangible objects. I would like to correct the translation. I would like to add, I wouldn't say correct it, but I would like to refine the translation. Like anybody, maybe Bernard or somebody else will be able to suggest how it should be refined.
Which word?
Realize that to be Brahman, which is non-dual, indivisible, one and blissful, and which is indicated by Vedanta as the irreducible substratum after the negation of all tangible objects.
Any particular word? Any particular word you are looking for?
Yeah. It's in the last phrase. I would like to make a change.
Should it be tangible and intangible?
That would be an addition, but it's not quite what I had in mind. Mine is more comprehensive than that. That's a possible emendation. Well, I would put it this way. After the negation of the names and forms of all tangible objects, the reality of those tangible objects is not negated. You don't negate the object. If you are a full knower of Brahman, a vijnani, you see this object as Brahman. It's the names and forms of the upadis. You can put it that way if you want. After the negation of all upadis of the tangible object.
So, Swami, the mirage is the names and the forms.
Yes.
What? You can't negate. It's all inclusive, so there is no negation. You can't negate a Brahman.
Right.
It makes you dividing Brahman, which
yeah.
Who would do it? So, thing we are attempting to negate, as it were, would be the stuff we make up.
The illusory. Illusory upadhis, or names and form. For instance, take the mirage in the desert. In a sense, you are negating the object because you see that it's not an oasis, or it's not water. In that sense, if you call it the object water, then you have to negate water. But you see, water is a name and an appearance. The phenomenon which caused you to see the mirage is still there. The physical phenomenon is still there in the light waves that brought the experience to your eyes. So, I would prefer that he said, after the negation of all upadhis, or the names and forms of all a tangible object. Anyway, non-dual, being one without a second, Brahman does not admit of any difference from objects of similar or dissimilar nature. Being of the nature of homogeneous consciousness, it does not admit of any difference arising from the diversity of its component parts. We understand the principle of homogeneity. You buy homogenized milk. What does it mean? It means milk in which all of the fat particles have been so distributed that they can no longer be easily separated from the rest of it, the non-fat. So, homogeneity is a concept we can grasp and understand. Something is called homogeneous, a population is homogeneous, when there are no minority elements in it. Britain used to be a homogeneous society before all of the parts of the Commonwealth started coming home, coming back to headquarters. There are countries which are homogeneous in their population. By the way, did I tell you the joke in Seattle? No. You go to Seattle, you see very, very few black faces. I told you this. Some of you heard? I didn't hear it. You see very few black faces. Once in a while, an African-American comes along. But they teased about this. These Scandinavian people of the state of Washington say, oh yes, we have integration here. The other day, a Finn moved next door to a Norwegian. So, homogeneity, Brahman, concept, get into our minds. No particles in it which are different from it. That, of course, negates qualified non-dualism. Vishishta Advaita is ruled out when you say that Brahman is homogeneous, because their idea of that of Brahman is it contains us as parts. It contains the universe and all these exist objects as parts of itself. Can't do that here. So, being of the nature of homogeneous consciousness, it does not admit of any difference arising. Vedanta, the philosophical system of the Hindus that embodies both the essence and conclusion of the Vedas. If the word anta, Veda, anta. Anta is cognate with our word end. Our word end comes down the line from anta. And in that sense, the conclusion, the finality of the Veda. But anta also has the meaning of essence, the core, the essence of the Veda. I mean, anta.
Go back just a second to the previous sentence. Its component parts, that's really to be avoided, isn't it?
It does not admit of any difference arising from the diversity of its apparent component parts, yes. We can do that for all night long and split hairs like that if you want. I started it, you carrying it on. Good for you. Then, generally speaking, it is represented by the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, and the Brahma Sutras with their commentaries. In other words, here is a list of what constitutes the Vedanta scriptures, the Shruti and the Smriti. Shruti is the Upanishads. Gita, Brahma Sutras, and their commentaries are Smriti. That's the top of the Smriti. There are lots of other Smritis, but this is the top level of the Smriti. Negation, a reference to the negative method of Vedanta for arriving at truth. Compare. Next follows the description of Brahman, not this. Or as I like to translate it, and John Dobson does too, not this, not that. There is no diversity whatsoever in it. Brihadaranyaka. He goes from death to death, who seems to see diversity in it. Now here, they've been very careful. And in fact, Swami Nikhilananda has put that in the translation. The verse actually just uses the word sees. And it assumes that you know that you're not really seeing it. But the original verse just uses the verb see. But this is more accurate. Who seem to see diversity in it. All right, we have time for another one. Let's go to 58. Deities like Brahma and Indra taste... Ah, here you are. You've got your deities in. Ganesha, Indra, Ganesha, all these... Here we go. These are the. This is just what Ravi was worried about. Deities like Brahma and Indra and Ganesha taste only a particle of the unlimited bliss of Brahman, and enjoy, in proportion, their shares of that bliss, of that particle. So, on a particle of that bliss, all these creatures live. On a little bigger particle of that bliss, all the gods live. It's still only a particle. And among the gods, there's a hierarchy. So Indra gets the more bliss than Ganesha, and so on. Ganesha gets more than Subramanian. Sorry. And so on. That is the way.
So if you say it is more acceptable than if I say.
Deities. In the Hindu religion and mythology, gods and deities are phenomenal beings subject to the laws of time, space, and causation. See, that's the, I'm going to say that's the beauty part of it. Now, that's, it really is, it's unique to Hinduism. Look at Islam. Everything that Muhammad heard and wrote down in the Quran came through the angel Gabriel. Everything came through Gabriel. There is no distinction really made in Muhammad's mind nor in the tribe mind between Gabriel and God, Allah. But because Allah cannot, has no form, has no mouth, nothing to speak with. So there have to be in-betweens. Like our devas, they have got angels. And the angel Gabriel is the mouthpiece of God, of Allah. And in fact, the Sufis have something even higher than Allah. It's called Al-Haq, the absolute. That's Sufi doctrine. But traditional Islam, Allah has to have a message. Has to have an intermediary. So he speaks through Angel Gabriel. And nobody ever says that the Angel Gabriel is a person with a position and one day he will fall. That's not brought in. No. We say that if there are gods like that, they too are subject to the laws of time, space, and causation. Meritorious and righteous men, after death, go to those positions. Those are posts. These are posts. And if I die, if I'm good enough when I die, I may get posted to the place of Indra or wherever. Maybe Ganesha. He's going to go to Ganesha.
Does the karma theory apply?
Yeah. In order to enjoy the fruit of their good action, these are the higher heavens, you see. Afterwards, they come down to earth in order. Now, see, there's and comes most, back.
Yeah.
Where your aunt is coming?
If I don't know.
Will your aunt come?
I don't
is she coming? To resume the thread of their worldly career. Being less gross than men, the gods and deities reflect more of the consciousness and bliss of Brahman. All right, so they're better reflectors. You send up something into the what do you call the outer space? Into the higher levels of the stratosphere, and those may be weather balloons or whatever. They will reflect the sunlight in a way better than something here on Earth. So you can send things up into the skies, which will reflect the light better than what you have on Earth. But that doesn't make them permanent. So the Brahma, the highest god, the personified cosmic soul, and Indra, the king of the gods, these are less gross than men, but still not Brahman. Taste only a fragment. This is because only a fragment of Brahman can be manifested through even the highest phenomenal medium. Huh? Always those upadhis are there. My upadhis may be heavy and strict and limiting and gross, and their upadhis may be very light, thin veiled. Yeah? Veils are thick and veils are thin. Clouds are cloud cover is heavy and cloud cover is light. They are like beings who are covered with very light clouds or very thin veils. That's all right, but still they have got coverings. So, in proportion as the gods differ from each other in respect of purity, Ganesha is very pure. So their enjoyment of the bliss of Brahman varies in proportion. Brahman manifests and sustains the entire universe with only a fragment of its being. Therefore, even the highest bliss of the world is only a particle of the bliss of Brahman. Compare. This is his highest goal. This is his highest success. This is his highest world. This is his highest bliss. All other creatures live. The same verse is being referred to. Or one. Let's see. Is that exactly the same as the other one?
Swamiji, where do the avatars fall in this category?
Hmm?
The avatars, you know.
Oh, what about the avatars?
Where do they fall?
Now that's another category. The avatar is in some ways superior to the gods.
In some ways is superior to the gods.
Mm-hmm. Though the avatar is Ishvara taking human form, still, as a human being, he has capacity and will demonstrate how to realize himself. Having been born into the human world, the avatar has the opportunity to take this body and mind and demonstrate how they can be divinized, as it were. No?
Mm-hmm.
Gods cannot do that.
Yes.
Yeah. So in that terms. Though they rate very high, they really are not as high as the avatar.
Sometimes we say avatars are incarnations of Krishna, for example, like Krishna.
Yeah. Devotees, devotional schools, the schools of devotional religion will identify their Ishvara avatar as Vishnu, because they like the idea that he sustains, not that he destroys. They're more interested in the sustenance of the universe. Shaivites.
Yeah.
Let him do what he wants. Try right. Let him destroy. He'll make another one.
Suddenly, I have one question here. It mentioned that Vedanta is a philosophy of Hinduism. Would you call that? Because one of the articles that I read in Living Wisdom by Pravrajika Vrajapana, it is a collection of
essays.
Yeah. I forget which Swami it was, but one of the articles written by who, I don't know, but he said that it is not right to call Vedanta a philosophy of Hinduism, but it is the fundamental core, the essence of everything that Hinduism
claims to be. That would be a better, more careful definition.
Yeah.
That would be a more careful
definition. And that's what would we call
and it? That's why Swami Vivekananda said that Vedanta is much bigger than Hinduism. It's much more inclusive, much broader. It's universal philosophy.
Or should we call it a basis, the fundamental core of
all religious philosophies? It happens that Vedanta was uncovered in India, and it belongs to the Hindus by virtue of its birth. But that doesn't make it a Hinduism.
But it's not philosophy. That's what he or she says.
Yes. All right. It's both religion and philosophy. That Swami Ashokananda used to say. It's not just a philosophy. It's not just a religion. It's both religion and philosophy together. Now I have something interesting here, an oddity for you.
Question.
Yes?
Is there anybody like who has realized Brahman without going to the farm or...
Yes, Swami Vivekananda.
Going to what? Without farm, I'm
sorry. Yeah.
Vivekananda
had that experience first.
Correct.
Then afterwards he saw the forms.
Oh.
Sri Ramakrishna said, Naran will go straight to the through the Brahman, and then he will see the beauty of Divine Mother and all that. This is a book by a friend of mine, a long time ago friend. I hoped that Shekhar would be here tonight to see it. I'll save it for him. It's by my friend whose name is Vikram Zaveri. And this is called The Theory of Periodic Relativity. Treatise on Vedanta, Physics, and Cosmology.
John Dobson, is
it? No, because I'll show you why.
Quantum physics or...
Anybody want to read it?
No.
Anybody want to read it? Every page is covered with equations. So, you know, I can't imagine. Now, let me tell you who he was. He is. This book is aimed at a select audience. Very select. Having math and physics background. The author proposes the author proposes an alternate theory to the Big Bang cosmology. The new theory is based on the Vedanta philosophy. Mr. Zaveri is a R&D mechanical engineer who has spent 13 years in the automotive industry with companies like Chrysler Motors. He has been a lead engineer on several projects such as Chrysler Corporate, Ford Crown Victoria, all kinds of things. Son of an owner of a watch and clock dealership in Bombay, he acquired his bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering from such and such R&D. He spent 10 years doing independent research. Anyway, it's a curio, and it's in our library. You would like to look at it.
How he became your friend?
Pardon?
He was your friend?
He stayed in the Vivekananda Monastery in Ganges.
Okay.
In fact, I think he wrote this in Ganges.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. So he lives right now in this country?
No, he went back to India. I've lost track of him. I imagine he's working in a clock shop or something.
No, the Indian Motor Company. No,
there are many examples in India who are.
See, you can have a new theory of the universe, but if you cannot make anybody else understand it, then where are you? Where are you?
That's a good combination.
Oh, we have to say our prayer.
Sorry, one more time. There are a lot of questions.
Okay.
See, mostly Hinduism, as you said, you know, Vedanta is the basis of Hinduism, many people say.
Yes.
But the concept of Brahman kind of a thing is not being said. But everybody says one thing, there is one God in Hinduism.
Mm-hmm.
But you start saying about Brahman, the formless and other things, mm-hmm. some people are a little like shaky about that, you know. They want to see Shiva or Vishnu or Ganesha, something like that. But when you say that one, they're a little like.
Yeah, well, Swamiji said, I believe in Brahman and the gods.
Yes.
Swamiji said, I believe in Brahman and the gods.
But people in general. It's not a very popular thing. Vedanta.
Yeah, last time I was
a very small segment.
But look how many people are here.
Last time, even in India, you know.
Yeah,
like most people live in Vedanta.
I lived in India. I know that nobody cares about Vedanta.
They don't care for Brahman. They care one God or whatever, Ishwar, whatever. They don't recognize
idol worshippers.
That's all right. You go to any villager, anywhere, and you ask him, is your idol under the tree, your image under the tree, is it really different from her picture of Divine Mother over there? No.
They are all
the same.
They
know that.
Everybody
knows
that. Everybody knows
that. They know the concept, but they don't put it as.
They don't make it real in their lives exactly. So, O Lord, lead us from the unreal to the real. Lead us from darkness to light. And lead us from death to immortality. May all be free from dangers. May all realize what is good. May all be actuated by noble thoughts. May all rejoice everywhere. May all be happy. May all be free from disease. May all realize what is good. May none be subject to misery. May the wicked become virtuous. May the virtuous attain tranquility. May the tranquil be free from bonds. May the free make others free. May good betide all people. May the sovereign righteously rule the earth. May all beings ever attain what is good. May the worlds be prosperous and happy. May the clouds pour rain in time. May the earth be blessed with crops. May all countries be freed from calamity. May holy men live without fear. May the Lord, the destroyer of sins, the presiding deity of all sacred works, be satisfied. For he being pleased, the whole universe becomes pleased. He being satisfied, the whole universe feels satisfied. Now about Sunday, you know, Brad Swears has been a student of ours for a number of years. There'll be more, 5 years or more. And he is enrolled in Candler Theological Seminary, and he's considered one of their brightest students. And he has done a beautiful paper on seva, service, as sadhana, as worship. Picking up Swamiji's idea of the worship of God in man. And so it'll be worth your coming to hear.